Okay. Well, folks, I think it's time for us to get started here tonight. Before we get started, just a brief reminder. I turned off my phone, so I'd encourage you please to ask you please to do the same, so we have fewer interruptions tonight. That would be great. Thank you. Well, my name is Derek Clausen. I'm an assistant professor in the Counseling Psychology program here at Trinity Western University. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. I was working together with Marcy Howell, who I'm going to introduce shortly, when we were working on figuring out, can we do something in 2 to 3 weeks? And I wasn't sure if we could do it, but it's, you know, seeing the attendance tonight is certainly nice. I'm sure glad that we did do something, and I'm glad that you're all here tonight. So I'd like to welcome you on behalf of Trinity Western University to our campus and on behalf of the Counseling Psychology program here. Trinity Western University and the Counseling Psych program here are the host of what is happening here tonight, but really the person who got us all started and got this started is Marcy Howell. And I'll just ask you, Marcy, if you would stand up, please. Marcy is part of the Philosophical Counseling Association, the student club at the University of Fraser Valley. I'm just very grateful, Marcy. You were the one who got us started on this and who made the contacts with Eifleet, so thank you. So this would have not been possible without you, so thank you. And thank you also. Please pass along greetings to your colleagues on the association, and thanks as well. One of the things that I get to do with some regularity, because Eifleet Lengle has been with us here in Canada. We've actually made him an honorary Canadian, because really he is with us in training seminars at least once a year since 2002. He's come here, and we had initially had some more informal training opportunities, but really a formal training program that got started here. It was originally at UBC in Vancouver, and then it's in other locations now. We have been starting that since 2007, so we're excited to have that training opportunity. And there may be a few of you here tonight who are, after this talk, or even maybe before this talk, are interested in the training opportunities. So I wanted to say just one or two words about that before we get going. For those of you who are interested in pursuing further training in existential analysis, I'm going to be sending around a sign-up list with email contact information. So if you want to receive further information about that kind of training, please put your name on there. If you've received this email directly from me about tonight, we don't need to do so, that it's fine, you'll hear from us anyway. But if you're not on my email list and you heard it from somebody else and would like to receive it directly, please feel free to do so. We have some information up here as well, information about the association and about the start of an association here in Canada. So if you're interested in that, please pick something up there as well. So Eifleet comes to us today actually after a long day of training. He came here to, this latest round came on Thursday and started training on Friday, and will go straight through until Sunday. So this is done after 5 days of continuous training and after a long day of training here. So very, very thankful, Eifleet, that even after that you would come and speak here tonight. Let me say just a few words about Eifleet. We got to know each other in 2001. Where I came to Vienna and invited Eifleet to come and speak at a conference here. And it's been just a real pleasure to have a connection with Eifleet and with the association that he represents, the International Society for Logotherapy and Existential Analysis. This is a society that was started jointly by Eifleet and by Viktor Frankl and by Gabi Frankl as well in the mid-1980s. And so it's very nice for us as a beginning group over here to have had that connection, that ongoing connection with this society. This is a class that just got out, and they've rushed over here to come be with us. Welcome. So that connection has been there, and we're very excited to continue that connection. And in fact, we're anticipating that this next year we will be launching our third cohort. So this is a timely opportunity for those of you who are interested in pursuing training. This is a possibility for doing this in the near future as well. So we're hoping, Alfred, you may say a few more words about this. We're hoping to start something next year. So, but it's very wonderful to have you here with us. For those of you who don't know Alfred Lenge was trained as a physician and as a psychologist. He worked in private practice and in a hospital for quite some number of years. Between the early 80s to the early 90s, he worked very closely with Viktor Frankl in Vienna. So Alfred comes to us from Vienna, has lived there for a long time and practices there as a psychotherapist and as a physician today. But most of the work that Alfred has done, especially recently, has been in doing training and developing a curriculum and in training psychotherapists in existential analysis. And so that's been a lot of the contact that we have had has been through that. So he's currently the president and he's the founder of the International Society for Logotherapy and Existential Analysis. It's the largest existential psychotherapy association worldwide with over 1,000 for sure, more than 1,000 people who've gone through at least a 4-year training there. So it has a lot of a lot of interest that has come out, not just somewhat in North America. We are starting in North America, but also a lot in South America, a lot in Western Europe, German-speaking countries in Europe, and also in Eastern Europe now. So it's very, very wonderful that you've come to us, Alfred, after such a long day of training, and we're very excited to be able to dialogue with you and to learn with and from you. So would you welcome, please, with me, Dr. Isaac. I will now send this around, so if you can pass it, please, for those of you who are interested in further information.
Yeah, thank you, Derek, for this nice introduction, and thank you, Marcy, for the organization and the invitation, and Derek, for the organization at Trinity Western, that you provided us with the possibility that we can come together and share an evening and talk about some issues which are so central for our existence and for our being, interesting for psychologists, especially because they are asked by many clients, patients, people who suffer and are stuck in their life about questions which are so human, so central in understanding of our being here, and which are so difficult sometimes to find an answer or to find a way to deal with. Maybe we don't even have so many answers, but we have ways to deal with. And I am very pleased that I get this possibility to talk about this. The theme is, I would like to start with the one element, one term of our theme, with the term of meaning. And to start that way, that when we are confronted with meaninglessness, what does that mean? When people come and say, I don't see any meaning in my life anymore, I don't see the meaning to stay any longer in my relationship or in my profession, I lost a comprehensive understanding of my being here, or since I'm sick, my life has no meaning, or since I lost my partner, my child. So there are many situations, possible situations, which can happen in everybody's life, which destroy the meaning. But what does it mean? Meaning, I remember when I started to work on that theme, Because I too lost my meaning when I was about 16. I had so many question marks around my life that I didn't know where to go and what for it is good and how I can understand my being here and why at all, and finally I will go to die and then it's over and what was it good for? So all these questions can come up, show up, of course by a philosophical questioning, but they can burn as existential questions. And when they are burning, they can even take us away all this connection to life which inhibit us to commit suicide. This question is an extremely potential question. If we do not have the answer, then the probability to commit suicide is much higher. Having no meaning, why should we continue in being there, in suffering? We may have fulfilled all our needs and desires, but having no meaning, you can't buy it with money, you can't make it with sex. You must find it with what? With your mind, philosophically, with your heart, with your feelings. How do we find meaning? And what is it at all? When we suffer from meaninglessness, what does this mean? It is, of course, a philosophical question, but it is more than just a thinking about an understanding. It is a need we have to orient ourselves in our decisions and in coming to a fulfillment in life. So when we lack from meaning, then we have a considered problem, and the problem is where to go. What is at what can I orient myself? Meaning means, what is meaning? Meaning in other languages says, for instance, in French, le sens, in Italian, senso, in Spanish, sentido. In Roman languages, they know what meaning is because of their word. When you stroll through Milano or Rome, then you see many signs with the term meaning on it, senso, and they even say unique meaning, senso unico. Senso unico means one way. So senso, or sentido in Spanish, means direction. And in Latin languages, you use that term to describe meaning. So in those languages, people know, have a better understanding of what is meaning. This means direction, to have a direction in one's life. You have it in English also, when you say, this doesn't make sense, or this makes sense. Sense is like senso, it's like sentido. But sense is also the senses with which we grasp information. So meaning is in this realm of direction, of having senses, and to be sensible. Meaning is a direction. When I do not see meaning in something, I'm lost. I do not know where to go. I have no orientation. And it tells me it's not worth to continue. Because if you continue, it will not lead to a good end. At the end, there is possibly nothing. It is absurd to continue. And this is a very important feeling. Meaninglessness is, of course, primarily a feeling. We feel that it is not worth to continue. So, meaning, when we suffer from meaninglessness, or in the contrary, when we feel or see a meaning in something, this means that the direction is correct, or when there is meaning. If I follow this direction, this leads me to something which is valid. If I have no meaning, then I know this direction doesn't lead to any value, any worth. I do away, and at the end, there is no reward. I get nothing. At least, maybe I'm lucky, but then it is arbitrary. It is a chance. This may be the case, of course. But as far as I see, there is nothing at the end. So then it's not worth to continue. And especially it's almost impossible to bear a suffering when at the end there is nothing good showing up. Do it for nothing is not the way how we can stimulate our will. Our will needs an orientation. We can move our will, we can motivate us, which is the same. Motivation is stimulation of the will. We can motivate us only when we see a value in front of us. Only a value awakens this spiritual energy in us, which is the will. It is not only, it has a psychic part in it, but in its essence, will is non-material, not materialistic. It is a spiritual power in us, that we can make a decision, that we can get engaged, that we can commit ourselves, means that there must be something like a value, something which attracts us. Otherwise, we are not motivated. When we do not see a value ahead of us, we are not motivated to continue. And the accompanying feeling is it has no meaning. It doesn't make sense. There is no orientation. Orientation gives me a sign and says, if you follow that way, then you will come to Vancouver or to Langley or whatever place you want to go. This is the goal. This is the value. There is my home, for instance, or there is the friend waiting. Then I'm oriented. I know where to go. And I look after the means to go there. We can put this notion, this first description of meaning, into a small picture which I want to draw you on the blackboard. This is the country road which brings me home. Meaning is like the sign which shows me the way to a value. Like, for instance, my home, or the place I want to go there, to go. Because I will meet someone. Or more in general, value is another term, a more abstract term of what is good. I remember when I started to work about the issue of meaning, I found it a term which was so different to grasp, to understand. And I had lots of discussions with Frankl on this, and Frankl worked his whole life on this issue. And in these discussions, and also what he told me, was that the issue of orientation is maybe the most practical and helpful to come to a quicker understanding. When I have this in mind, and therefore I made it with a little picture, because pictures we remember better than abstract definitions. So I give you an abstract definition afterwards. So with such a picture, yeah, we can grasp the central issue. To be on a right way, this is a meaningful life. A right way, the way is right when it leads to an end or to a point for which it is worthy to live. For instance, coming here this evening, the motivation is I can expect something valuable. I will possibly hear something which is helpful for my own life, for my thinking, or my relationship, or my work in which I am, because we may have patients who suffer often from meaninglessness. So this is the value of this evening. Coming here, therefore, is meaningful, and I am motivated to come because I can expect at the end should show up this meaning, or you not only at the end, from the beginning, I hope, is there something good, interesting, attractive, and so on. Of course, it may be a failure that the Derek's announcement was so perfect that it promised more than Alfred really brought. So then we are disappointed at the end. This may happen. Life is a risk. But it was meaningful until I have seen at the end there's no value. So if you see that it is obvious that Alfred doesn't bring that value which I expected, it's better you go home. And then I can go home. Because when it doesn't have a meaning, it's not worth the time to spend here. Time is an investment of life. And investment of life should reward the effort. So, orientation is meaning. It makes sense as long as we see and feel a value. The value, the detection of value, of course, is something which cannot only be done intellectually. Values which are relevant for existence, which has an existential impact, those values must be felt. We need feeling, and this is a mistake which is done, which happens very often in people, that they neglect or devaluate their feelings and think they can come to a good life only intellectually. We are beings who are bestowed with an emotional capacity, and this emotional capacity is very important for the direction of our life. Emotions are detectors of what is relevant for our life. they are not only a shadow which follows a recognition, as some people think or treat them. Emotions detect what touches life or how life is affected by a situation. So when we devaluate emotions and treat them as secondary effects or byproducts of the cognitive, then we are in danger to fall into a meaninglessness, because we must feel our life, otherwise it's not a rewarding life. Values must be felt. If they are only rational, they will not carry me through the situation. There are situations like a student which came to me by saying, I'm no more able to learn for my final exams in the fifth year of my studies of law. I was very effective and very successful at the beginning. I did it in the first year. I was ahead of time even, and I did all my exams by the latest when I was possible to make them. But since a year, I have difficulties, and now I lack only three more exams to finish, and I'm not able anymore to do it. And it really doesn't make sense to me anymore. But I know it is very important to finish my study and to have the title, and then I can work as a lawyer, and I have a career ahead. I know where I could start. It's rational. It's absolutely clear. And I want to finish, but I can't. I don't memorize anymore. And I'm not even motivated to... I want to finish, but I'm not motivated to open my books. When I should do it, when I plan to do it, then I see the book and then I go and do some cooking, or I go to play piano, or I read a book, a novel, or maybe this is something you can't imagine that this happens. But it happens sometimes in Europe. And of course it's very rational when you have to do only three more exams to finish your studies. He invested so much already. I asked him if he ever liked this study. He said, yeah, sure. My father told me that it's the best study you can do. And I said, yeah, your father gave you a good explanation what it is worthy for, but yourself, do you think it's a valuable study, it's something interesting and good? He said, it's very useful. I'm convinced, and I know it, and I see it. I said, you say useful, but is it good in itself? And he had no real understanding of what is good. He was so oriented in usefulness and mixed up usefulness with the quality of a value, of being good. This usefulness is a value, but it's a functional value. It's not an intrinsic value. The intrinsic value is when I study, when I learn, that I find it interesting what I learn. When I do not find it interesting, I do not reach the intrinsic value. And interesting means that it attracts me. I have a good feeling when I do it. I I'm eager to do it. Maybe not, certainly not every day, but again and again. And if it's not so, my feeling tells me it's not worth living. But he was a very bright and intellectually clever guy. With his intellectuality, he overruled himself. He overruled his existential orientation. And so he wasn't aware that this was no longer life, to study law. I asked him if he had hobbies, if what he really likes to do. He said, I like doing cooking and what else? Yeah, playing piano. If he plays well piano. He said, yeah, quite well. This is really something which I like to do. And so during the whole day now I play piano and I don't study anymore. So then I said, then you have a good time, don't you? So, if I wouldn't have that bad conscience, yeah. But in itself, it's good, but I'm not allowed to play piano. And I said, why not? When you do it, when you like it to do so much, did you ever think about studying music or something? He said, oh yeah, at high school, I always wanted to become a pianist. But with playing piano, you don't make so much money. So it's not so valuable. It's not so functional. We continued in that way, and it turned out that from his heart, from his nature, he was a musician. He was a musician and not a lawyer. And he did a functional decision, a rational decision, not feeling that value, but only thinking that value, that it is, of course, you can make more money normally with working as a lawyer than with working as a pianist. And so he did not live after an existential value, after something which he himself felt as being good. And so he lost his way, his heart, his lack of motivation, his feeling of meaninglessness, which he didn't even accept as being of value, this feeling of meaninglessness, because it must have that meaning. But he was stopped by his psyche to continue in a way which is not his. He didn't live himself. He lived an alien life. A strange. He was a foreigner of his own existence. And so it is so helpful when we take seriously our feelings of meaninglessness, because they tell us something is wrong. The direction is not correct. And a central question in this is, do you feel the value, or do you only think it's a value, what you are following? And if I don't feel it, it's not in my heart. I do not live with my heart. And then it's not a complete life. So to end up this first question, or this first notion about meaning, a feeling of meaning says me, this is a direction you can continue that way. If I feel meaninglessness, then this tells me, don't continue. Stop it, take your time, look around, look inside, look outside, look after other values, and look inside. If you are with you, if you are in tune with you, but don't continue. Don't live in an extrovert way. have first a check of what is what really matters you. When I don't see the meaning to continue in a relationship, this means when I'm together with you, what will come out? We do not have good time together. There's no joy anymore. It's effort taking. It's even painful or so. Is it really worth to continue? Or my job? You can take whatever you want. The feeling of meaning is the orientation. We can define meaning in a bit more an abstract way and say meaning is the best possibility in a given situation. The worthiest possibility. Possibility means something which I can do. I do not have to do. I'm not forced to. Possibility is to come here tonight. Another possibility is to go to the cinema or to meet a friend or to study or whatever. There are many possibilities we have in every moment. Which one is the best one suiting to the situation and suiting to myself? Suiting to myself to what I can do, I like, I'm interested in, because it's important for me, and for a greater context. So these are some elements which are basic, and I will come back to them later on in my talk. The best or the worthiest possibility in this situation, for this evening, for tomorrow. In a way, it's very simple. If I have a notion, if I have a good feeling for value, for worth, for the good, and if I am clear in that what touches me, then we do not even think about meaning. It's very natural, not even, we do not have to think about meaning when we are in meaning, when our life is full of meaning. Why should I think about it? Then it is in the club of philosophy. We sit together and reflect, what can meaning be at all? This is like a luxury, but it's not an existential need. It is theoretical interest, it may be of scientific interest, you may do empirical research, and so that's also important and nice and good, but this is not the element we have to do in psychotherapy. In psychotherapy we have people who suffer from meaninglessness, at least sometimes we have such people, suffer from meaninglessness and do not know how to continue their life. And when I do not know how to continue, I start thinking about killing myself, about stopping it. How should I, after a great loss, of course, how can I be able to continue? When I lose my partner or my health or something which is so basic, important, great value in my life, then of course we need some time to reflect upon, to reorient ourselves. We need the time for grief. We need the time of silence. We have to step back. And for a certain time, it's very natural not seeing any meaning, not having the orientation. We are not machines who, by a pressure of a knot, produce the next meaning when we lose the first, the one before, or so. We need our time. And this, sometimes in psychology, give this notion to the patient, to say, take your time. Now you are wounded. You suffer a great loss. This is like an existential amputation, where you lose a leg, an arm. you cannot continue in the same way as before. You need a new orientation now. And this needs time, that after the shock and after the trauma, after the pain, when it starts healing, that you have a fresh look in your life. And then you will find a new orientation. Take your time. I go with you. I accompany you. Take your time. You will find it. And we do it together. And so we can bridge difficult life situations. Sometimes we need some time. And it is okay not seeing a meaning when there is a great loss we suffer from. Frankl, whose life turned around the meaning issue and finding meaning, described a fundamental attitude which helps to find meaning. Let's come to this section now. After the first description of meaning, including a short definition as the best or most valuable possibility in a situation, let us now look at how can we find meaning. And meaning is can be found. There are different methods, techniques, approaches, but there is one attitude which is very basic to for finding meaning. It's the attitude of openness. Existential meaning must be something real, something which I perceive, which I do not construct, which I do not project, which I see as a real possibility in my actual life. A real value must be seen. And Frankl described this openness by coming from his practical work, that many people are blocked in finding meaning because they are not open enough, and they are occupied with their own wishes, needs, desires, projects, goals. The goal orientation is a very utilitarian attitude. And so they do not see the chance of life, the invitation of life. And he said, for most people, for many people who suffer from meaninglessness or have difficulties, it needs to make an existential turn, a turn of 180 degrees. Because most people block themselves because they always look after, what do I get? If I do this, what do I get? What does it bring to me? What is the win? And they look after their own goals and check the reality behind, after what gives me the fulfillment of my goal, what do I receive? And he said, if these people make a turn of 180 degrees, then they change from people who ask, who question their life and their situation, into a person who is asked by life. The existential turn, therefore, consists in openness in which we experience ourselves as being asked by our situation, by our life. So, the basic attitude, or the best attitude to come to an existential meaning — an existential meaning means which really gives that support that I can lead my life and continue in my life — this turn consists in an attitude to understand myself of being asked by the situation. This situation now, if you take it as an existential attitude, is asking you, what are you going to do with what you hear? This question is always present. Whenever I realize something as being there, something that exists, I can take it as a question to me. And the basic question is always, what are you going to do? There is a cup. The cup is there, and the cup asks me, in a figurative way, what are you going to do with me? Are you using me? Are you throwing me away? Are you neglecting me? What are you going to do? Because I have the capacity to decide. As a human being, I'm free. And I can make use of things. I can connect or not. So I am, by my essence of being a person, by my essence of being a free personality, I'm constantly, fundamentally asked by anything around me, what are you going to do with this? So we understand ourselves in that existential sense, understanding. We understand ourselves as being asked. Being human means fundamentally being asked by life, by any situation, by whatever happens. If there's a cancer showing up, it's the same question as if I'm falling in love. Again, in both situations, I'm asked, what are you going to do with it? I'm falling in love does not mean that's not a decision to do what I do. I'm free to start a relationship or not. More or less free. I can be pushed more and be so highly attracted that it's hard to resist. Of course, there are very strong values. But the question is it okay with you? What is the best to make of it? I am the creator of the quality of my life. I am at least the co-creator of the quality of my life. What are you going to do with this? Being human means being asked, constantly asked by whatever is around. A loss, a tragedy, is the same being asked as the offerings I get, the chances I have. I decide about my life. Existence is what I decide. Existence is more than just being there. Existence means a constant decision of who I am. I have this responsibility for my life. And so all these concepts, anthropological concepts, enter in this simple existential turn. To turn around and to open myself, to set aside my wishes, my needs, my desires, to set them aside for a minute, and let me ask for my situation. Maybe you listen to me right now, or maybe you follow your thoughts, or you are caught by a memory. And it may make more sense to follow your memory or to follow your own thoughts than to listen for a minute. Then you may come back. Whatever shows up is a question, what are you going to do? And we always have to make this decision and to evaluate what is of higher value when I do what at that moment. Because what comes up in you by listening may be of much more importance for you, for yourself, than what I'm talking, and after a minute you can follow anyway. So, being asked by life in general, by that situation in concrete, and existence means giving my best answer to the question of the situation by answering. Answering in means in an active doing, in practicing, in an action. So this is, if we condense that existential term into a phrase, we can say, I repeat, being human means being asked. And life or existence is giving my answer to the questions of life, to the questions which I have understood. The answer is preceded by a question, otherwise it's not an answer. A question which I have understood. What is the question of my life, actually? What is my life actually asking me? What does it want from me? This existential turn to make myself open to possible values in my life. And I feel it. I feel if there is something which is waiting for me, which I should do, which I should possibly have done a long time ago already, which I owe to somebody, which I should meet somebody or speak to somebody or finish a work, or what is my life asking me in that small horizon of a day, in that bigger horizon of a week? And fundamentally, what is the question in my life actually? What does this life want from me? Where I am irreplaceable, where only I can give the answer, because I am the partner or the father or the mother or the one in charge, or because only I see it, or because it's my life. So the existential turn calls us, and we experience ourselves as being asked. And this is important, because we all know how we suffer when we are not asked. When my friend, my partner, do not ask me anymore where to go at the weekend or so. Decide simply. So if you want, you can come. If you don't want to, do not come. Take it as you like. Well, what kind of relationship is that? If the partner comes and says, let's think, what are we going to do this weekend? I'd like this, what do you like? The same or something? And then we may struggle and fight, because I want to go to the sea, she wants to go to the mountains, and maybe we go separately. But we have talked about it. This is important. And we have asked each other. Being asked means I have some importance. And feeling, if we take this notion that by our essence of being a human being, which is in its essence is a free person who has, at least partially free, but we have to make decisions. If we take this, then I can understand me constantly as a person who is being asked. My life asks me. So I am somebody in my life. I have an importance. And I am the central important person in my existence, of course. So existential turn is a bit unusual, maybe, because in our times we live in a very functional way, and we are taught to and trained to look after the success and the win and the what we get, and they have a feeling that we are loser when we do not fight for what we get. We may do it, but this is not what existentially gives an existential fulfillment. The fulfillment is when I understand the question of my life in the concrete situation, when I give my answer. So the question for your life in this moment can be, can I understand? Can I apply this? Do I look after what I am asked by my life actually? Do I find it easily or do I have difficulties? Did I practice it right now? This is a question which I bring up, but it's a question of the situation, the application of what we talk. What am I asked? What is my most burning question of my life, actually? Where I feel I should do that, this is important. That makes meaning. This is the meaning, an existential meaning, one of several meanings. We have several meanings at the same time. One of these meanings to look after that where I feel asked. To give the answer brings me to the third point which I want to bring you tonight, to the consent. Giving the answer means I do the best what I am capable for in answering. For instance, I may feel that I should call my mother or see her. I didn't see her for a long time. So these are such practical issues, but I feel in a way it corresponds, she deserves it, she's waiting for it, I know it. It's corresponding to my love to her, and I was very busy, of course, last time, but I feel it's time now, it's high time, at least to call her. Or this can be, for instance, a situation, or this being asked by the situation, actually. And my working, or my teaching, or my learning, and so, is also a constant questioning of when do I do it, how much do I do it. And so I evaluate and say, maybe this weekend I go home and see her. What I do should correspond to me. Maybe I feel my mother would like to see me, but I have difficulties with her. So it wouldn't correspond to me to go home and to see her, although she is expecting it. So maybe the question is then, how should I work on this difficulty I have with her? Maybe the best is not to see her for, let's say, until Christmas, so that she really understands that I have a serious problem with her, because I may have tried to talk with her and she didn't take me seriously. So maybe this information which I give her by not seeing her is more important than to see her. Not to make it too easy to her, and not to force me, because I feel this wouldn't correspond to my type form of relationship I have to her. So you see, meanings are individual. They are, if they have to suit to the person involved, to persons involved, and to the situation. If my mother is deadly ill, then it would change. Then I would say, well, in that such a case, I forget my difficulties. This is maybe the last chance I have to see her, and then I would go. So meanings are flexible. I'm asked for my answer, but this answer should correspond to me and to that situation. And therefore, we have to have a look at, do I have a consent to what I'm going to do? What does this mean, consent? To have an inner consent means I feel a yes to what I do. I feel it, a sentiment, it's a consentiment. It's an approval, a felt approval. And we have that immediately. We almost always know about and feel our consent, if it's there or not. For instance, right now, you're certainly aware if you have a consent to be here or not. If you feel it in, yes, it's okay, I'm in tune with it, it's harmonizing with me, it's interesting, it gives me something, or so, then you most probably have an inner consent. You may even say, well, I know at home I have a little child and it's already 8 o'clock and I should go home quickly then, but let's say until 8:30 it's okay. If it lasts longer, then I have to go. Although it's interesting, but something else is another value comes up and becomes more and more important. And then I do no longer have the consent to stay here. I feel it's not good, it's not correct. It is good in itself, but compared with the other value, the child at home, I should go. So the inner consent is a flexible evaluation of the situation. And consent means yes, but it's a felt yes. It's a yes which resonates in me, which I do not make. I do not produce that make. It may be irrational, or I may possibly not even be able to explain it, but I feel. And so we describe in existential analysis the main road to fulfillment in life. Fulfillment in life is needs this correlation with the inner attunement, with the inner consent. Only with inner consent we can come to a fulfilled life. Fulfillment in life needs me, my personal consent to what I do. And the more often I do things for which I have a consent, for which I feel this inner yes, yes I want, yes it is important, yes, I like. Yes, I can. North America. Yes, this makes sense. Yes. the complex yes. The more I feel this yes in what I do, the more fulfillment I get. And something more arises. As a result, the fulfillment of life comes in. By the way, by that road of inner consent, which includes meaning, but a bit more. Another element, another result comes up. Not only the fulfillment of life, but also the power in my life. What I do with inner consent, there I am personally present. I'm more effective, I'm more powerful, I'm more committed with inner consent. Commitment is only possible with inner consent. Commitment is inner consent. Engagement. Engagement means I personally am in that what I do. To live with inner consent means that me as a person, who I am, in my freedom, with my essence, am in that what I do. And of course, when I am personally present in listening here, or in writing an email afterwards, or in studying, or working, or in loving, in sexuality, whatever, listening music or playing music, when I'm personally present, or present, when I'm personally present, then I'm rewarded. I am there and I can receive the value with which I have to do. I receive that joy which it makes to be able to do that. I receive the joy of you being here and being able to talk about this. This is wonderful. This is a gift of the day. So then this gives me fulfillment. And I can do it in a committed way. And I am there. And I am present in my life. And this is existence. Existence is when I am really present in what I do. And I can feel free in what I do. Because it's me. It corresponds to me. It resonates with me. I am essentially there. Fully there. When I'm fully there, I receive fulfillment. I experience fulfillment. So the notion or the idea of a life with inner consent is absolutely central in existence. Otherwise, it's not my existence, it's not my life. We can live strange lives. We can live the life of my father who wants me to study law. We can live the life of my partner who wants me to be so. And we do not ask after our, when we do not ask after our yes, after our consent, if we simply give in, we land ourselves. Instead of commitment, we have landing ourselves. And this is emptiness. This leads into emptiness. This brings up the feeling of meaninglessness. When I land myself, I am not born and I am not here in this world to land myself. I have the right and the destiny to be myself. This is the task of being an individual in one's life. To mark my boundaries, to mark what is important for me, to fight for that, to talk about it and to do where I have the inner consent. Without inner consent, it's not worth living. Stop when you do not have the inner consent. Try as much as you can to do with inner consent, or let it be. Let it go. Life is too worthy. Prefer to do nothing than something without inner consent. We only lose without inner consent. Inner consent we describe as being this inner yes to what we do. We may read a book. As long as I feel inner consent, I continue. If the consent goes away because I'm too hungry, too tired, or it's no more interesting, then I stop. And so I'm flexible. And I'm always with me, with myself. I go with myself, arm in arm, accompanying myself in what I do. Inner consent, it may be in work. It may be even in suffering. If I have inner consent in suffering, I suffer less. Consent in suffering means, well, I have my headache or my back pain, and I do what I can to improve the situation, but until the medication helps or until the physical treatment helps, and so I'm ready to accept it. And acceptance means I let it be. I don't fight it. I can't do more. But why should I be unhappy that it's there? My question is to give my best answer. My best answer to that situation is to look after improvement, treatment. The rest is not my duty. I let it be. I let it go. I did for what I had consent. And the rest I accept. Accept means simply, well, it's there. I can bear it. I can bear it. That's something, bearing something, being capable to support a situation which I cannot change or cannot do more. This is not passivity, it's not resignation. This is activity. This means I remain on my place. I don't give up. I claim my presence. It's a decision. It's existence. Life with inner consent is a yes to life. And this yes to life includes some difficult situations which we cannot choose or change or which happen. So, this yes to life is a complex thing. So far, we spoke until now, this yes, this inner consent looks like being something simple, but in fact it can be very complicated, because it needs a dealing with the fourfold structure of existence. Our existence has like four dimensions, like the windrows, north and south and east and west,
directions.
The directions, the four directions of, one direction is, these are elements of our existence which are constantly there, which we cannot avoid. We must deal with the fact that we are in this world. That's the first direction. dealing with the world, with the facts, with the givens. May it be a headache, but and is it? May it be the economic situation? May it be my health? The real things in this world and its conditions, we have to deal with them, otherwise we do not survive. We must be prepared for winter, otherwise we will die in the in the frozen air outside. So if we do not adjust and adapt and change where it is possible, the conditions, we cannot survive. So this means acceptance and endurance and bearing and being able to do something, capacities, abilities, apply them, knowledge, apply them, technical procedures. This is all included in our consent, that we make use of this, because this is the fundamental basis of our existence. Our yes, this inner consent includes a yes to the conditions under which I am. Sometimes we have to work on these conditions to improve them, because we experience we cannot survive, we cannot be. This life with inner consent is preceded by this first existential question. I'm there, but can I be under these circumstances of my relationship, of my health, of my economic situation, at my working place, can I be there? Can I? The second dimension, the second direction in our life, which we cannot escape, is the fact that we are living, we have a life. And being alive means that we have feelings, we are in relationships, we have good feelings, warm feelings, but also pain, suffering. We have desire and pleasure and lust and feel values. And this brings us up the existential question of life itself. I am alive, but how is this for me? We are all experts of our life. We have enough experience so that we have a notion of the quality of our life, of the quality of life itself. Is this life worth to be lived? Do I, after my experience, if I ask myself personally, after my consent for life, is it good to live this life, my life? I have been born, I didn't do that. It happened to me. I wasn't even asked. So this is a tremendous thing. It made me make rebellious that I have to be here and haven't been asked. But life asks me. Now I'm asked. I do not have to continue. Now I'm asked. Do I like to be alive? To be there? Is it something which has a value for me? I'm sure nobody sitting in here has a perfect life. We all could say it could be better. And I didn't want to have to suffer this and to lose that. And I'm sorry about the guilt there and the mistake here. But in a total, is this being alive something which has a value in itself, an intrinsic value? Do I have a feeling for that? An idea? And do I want to relate to this life? to connect with it, to live my life. So life with inner consent, existence, means also this dimension, this connection to life, to feelings, to including suffering, and drives and instincts and all that what belongs to life. And we are asked to look and to find out if this is of value or not. Then a third dimension is, after the world, the conditions and life, the fact that we are here only as subjects, as individuals, as persons. I'm always me throughout my whole life. I'm never somebody else. I have to be myself in this life. I cannot escape that fact. I can separate from my partner. I can get divorced, but not from me. This would be suicide. So, I must arrange it with me, with my personality traits, with my behavior. But this, of course, brings up the question, how is that for me? Can I accept me? I'm there, and I'm me. Is it okay with me, the way I am, and the way I behave, the way I act? Can I stand behind it? Is it allowed to be so, and to act in that way? Is it permitted? Do I permit myself to be so, and to act that way? The ethical dimension of human existence shows up. Is it allowed? Do I permit myself to have such a belly? A bit too much, I would say, for me. To be so as I am, this means physical appearance, personality. Can I stand behind me, identify myself with myself, with my body, with my psyche, with my, and then of course, with my behavior? Can I show myself as I am, how I think, how I decide? Can I let it be seen by others? Or do I feel shame if they only knew what's going on within me? I would fall in shame. I would feel ashamed. Do I have to adapt? Do I have to hide myself because I have the fear that I wouldn't be loved if I really showed who I am? So I show a nice face, smiling face, but behind that face it looks differently. Where can I be really as I am? Do I allow me to be who I am? Do I choose, do I make decisions in a way that I can let me see? Highly ethical questions. Questions of identification, questions after authenticity. Who am I really? Is this corresponding with myself? How I look, how I work, how I love, how I fight. And the fourth dimension of existence is the greater context, the future. This is the dimension where meaning shows up. The question is, I'm there, but what for? I'm here, what for? What for do I live? what is the direction of my life, to what end leads this, what I do, and in which context, in which greater context do I find myself, do I see myself? I may live for my partner, my family, my friends, for my patients, greater context in which my life is placed, and where I can experience that my being there is fruitful. It is a deep need of all life to bear fruits, to be fruitful. This is a meaning of life. To not have lived only for myself, but also for others. To have been of value also for others, which transcends my existence. It makes it bigger. It adds my own being there a value which is much more than my own life, because it is given to something, to some other value, to somebody. It is dedicated to a work where it bears, where it brings up, has a valuable effect. Then my life is meaningful, when I see that it bears fruit, that it produces something good. So these are the four dimensions which are included in the inner consent. To have a full inner consent means that I can really deal with the reality, with the facts, and accept them, and can be there. It means that I like what I do. This means I connect with life. When I do what I like, then my life is in resonance with what I do. The third dimension is this ethical dimension, being myself, which means that I have the feeling it is important, it corresponds to me and my essence, it's authentic, and I'm allowed to do it. I can permit me. And the fourth, there is a need around me. There is something waiting for me, asking me, can you contribute? Can you do something so that a value shows up at the end? The meaning. Something which I ought to do, which I shall, which is required. And I feel there is an objective requiredness. Natural objective requirednesses are children. They need the mom. They need the parents. They say, this is an objective requiredness. Of course we know a child cannot survive. And so we are surrounded by requirements. If we correspond, if we give our answer to them, then we feel it meaningful. We can be, we like to do what we do, it is permitted to do, and we ought to do it because it's needed. Then we have the full and integral inner consent, and we have a huge capacity in ourselves. With this I'm ending presentation. We can have some discussion or common reflections on it. We have a huge capacity in ourselves. The capacity to reduce this complexity of existence into a single feeling. Feelings are complexity reductions. With that feeling of yes or no, we have a guideline which leads us to inner fulfillment and to a fulfilled life. And I hope this evening may contribute a bit to this, our deep desire to have a fulfilled life. life and to contribute to something more good in our surroundings, which is our world. Thank you for listening. There are questions or remarks or contributions. Yeah. Are meanings objective or subjective? Is there a process to go through? Can we even come to objective meanings? What a tricky question. Don't you have an easier one? Shall I answer objectively or subjectively? What happens when I get wrong? What gives me the security to be right? Or is there a risk? There is a risk. There is objectivity in the sense of that meaning is proved, is guaranteed, and you get your money back if it isn't. So this doesn't exist. Life is a continuous risk, but the trick in this question is that meaning has an objective part in it. Objective in that sense that I perceive a real demand, I perceive a real need, or I perceive a value, and this is there. And many other people can see it. But it is only partly objective, because at the same time it is subjective. It must be subjective, because it must be the orientation for my life. And my life, I am subjective. I am a subject. I am not an object. If you make me an object, I feel reduced. If you only see my function, then I'm used as an object. I'm a subject with an autonomous capacity of decision, with dignity as a person. So I am absolutely necessarily subjective. And meaning, as an orientation for me as a subject, therefore must be subjective, although it has an objective element in it. And it's even more, Frankl states that it's subjective, it's objective, it's also relational and relative. Relative relate means in the relation to the situation and in the relation which I have to the object, to the value. And so meaning is subjective, objective, relative, depends from the situation, this existential meaning. There is an ontological meaning, also the religious meaning, which is a different meaning. But the existential meaning, my orientation for my decisions, for my activity, is necessarily objective, subjective relation. And there is no security. We can never be sure if I do the best. We can only feel that for the moment I do not know better. That's our human dimension. And that's enough. It may turn out at the end that it was not good, but it was meant good. It was intended. It was checked, examined as much as I could, and with the limited notion and the limited reflection and perception and feelings, I did the best that I could. And so it is important that others tell me how they see it, and that we are in a dialogue about it, so that I can widen, broaden my horizon and see more aspects than I see alone, before I see more than two. This is the risk of our life, and there are parents who, as young people sometimes get crazy about it, who say, I only wanted the best for you. And they didn't see how the children suffered. And we wanted the best for you. Yeah. This may happen. It may have been meaningful for these parents. And when children grow up, then they come and say, it wasn't. It was, we suffered. We couldn't say it. But now I see. That's the risk of life. So we have a moral conscience which gives me a certainty, but not security. I can be half sure, but wholehearted. I can be convinced and feel certain about what I do, although certainty is never objective security. It's subjective maximum of security. Thank you for the question. There was another.
Yeah, can you talk about the center of meaning and how it affects like a collective culture, collectivism, where there's when I listen to you, it's a lot more individual, right? And I know that in the meaning you create community and relationship. But what about whether there's a strong collective overtone, for example, when you do therapy with other cultures?
That's your question. I repeat the question because not everybody may have heard it. I hope I repeat it correctly, otherwise you correct me. The question is there an object, is meaning only subjective, or is there a general understanding of meaning which may be an overtune in a society and in a culture, and how do I treat different meanings in different overtones in cultures?
Yeah, from the individual to
from
group.
How can we come from the individual to the group? Yeah. The existential understanding of meaning, in fact, is a subjective understanding and an individual understanding of meaning. Like responsibility, like freedom, these are individual capacities. Is there a freedom of a society? To a certain degree, it is based in the freedom of the individuals as a sum or as a playing together of mosaic stones which make the picture of the society. So similar it is with meaning, or with responsibility, or guilt. We had this long issue after World War II about collective guilt. Is there collective guilt at all? Viktor Frankl was one of the forerunners against any notion of collective guilt. He said, if we come up with collective guilt, then this hurts many people who are Austrians or Germans, but didn't do anything or were even in the resistance. But as Germans and Austrians, they are made guilty. Guilt is a personal issue, and only there exists only personal responsibility and therefore only personal guilt. I share this opinion, and it It is similar in the concept of meaning. Meaning is an orientation for the subjective life. We can bring together some objects, some objective values, like human rights, for instance, and say, we fight for human rights. This is a collective value, a value which should be valuable for everybody. Some states won't follow. But we can fight for it, and it is meaningful to fight for it. But who is the authority who says, you, who brings everybody to accept it? It ultimately, it remains something individual. Although we should fight for common values, and say change. Is economic growth a value? It was for the last 50 years. Constant growth was a value. Now we are very in doubt. And we all know there is no growth which does not end. And so we must have new concepts. And now we are searching for new meanings. So it's like in the individual life, there is a parallel in the cultural life, in the common life, that for a certain period of time, we have values which we follow, let's say, to a great deal of the, a great part of the population follows these values. And then when the time changes, we have to look after new values. These are then the new collective meanings, the collective values. It, the same notion. Collective meaning is following a collective value. This is a short and certainly insufficient answer to this big question. Thank you. Sorry, when the person decides to...
To take a path that is equally meaningful, but you put you in something that's also meaningful, they have a new path.
Yeah. Just before I answer the question, we have here beautiful, good chocolate, which Mercy brought, and coffee, but also some handouts, a short description of this existential structure I was speaking about. So you have a summary, a survey, a bit of what I was talking here, and one book on existential analysis, which is, of course, not for free, but the rest is for free. Conflicting values and conflicting meanings, this happens, of course, not only in studying. It happens in very often in relationships. That one person loves two persons at the same time, which is an evident conflict, and which produces a lot, can produce a lot of suffering. What can we do in conflicting values? Both is meaningful. The one person and the other person, and I love both. Like here in the studies, that the person may continue, this person, this student couldn't continue with his study. He stopped studying laws and started to study music. So, And he was finally encouraged enough to do it, and it was clear for him. It needed 9 sessions that he was ready to really make the end of the old life and start a new one. The conflicts of meanings are conflicts of values. What do I do when there are 2 values which are of the same size, the same attraction? And this may happen. What we can do is, what we need to do is to take time first and to really accept that I am in a conflict, that I am ambivalent. Ambivalent. 2 values are there. And I cannot make a decision right now. In the case of partnerships, if in such a situation, this person cannot make a decision, actually, a real decision. Of course, one can say, I do this or I do that, or I throw the coin and take the number and go there. But this is not decision. Decision with the inner consent, in that case, means that the situation must mature. And taking time means that I best step back from both values and be with me and listen into me. Maybe it shows up and I feel and see and understand what is the correct, and I feel and see that I can endure the loss of the other value. Maybe I do not. What do I need in such a case? Then I need more contact with both values, with this value and the other value, to get to feel more, to have more information. In most cases, then it becomes clearer. In such cases, it may happen that both women go away and leave me alone and the situation is resolved. But it may not be the case. Or one goes, then it starts a resolution. So then we need more information if we cannot decide. And finally, if even this doesn't help, it's very important to talk with other people about it. Talking about it gives me a certain distance. It makes me more evident how important it really is, how valuable it is, how others resonate, what they bring in as views and reactions, and this enriches me. And this finally may help me to come to a decision. And if all this doesn't help, it doesn't matter which decision I make. It's still the same. Both are equally valuable. And I can really throw the coin over it and say, I take this or that. There is no reason why I should prefer this value before the other value. And make a decision. I cannot make a decision if it remains in the same size, if the both values remain to be in the same size and in the same attraction. Maybe I can live both. I know one man who lives with 2 women since 20 years, and the three are happy with each other. It's also possible. It's maybe a new style of life. But you see, the importance is not to fulfill a norm. The importance is to really fight for myself, for my authentic decision, and to try to explain me to, in such a case of relationship, to these other people and not to hurt too much, but of course, normally this is a hurting situation for all people involved. but to really fight for myself, I suggest this as because it means to live my life despite of the pain which is in it, and then this is true life. It's maybe not the easiest, but it's more rewarding. Is this an answer, an idea of an answer of your question?
Yes, I'm going to have the same problem as you were having with women.
So it's a good idea, yeah? Yeah. Okay, you, and then you. Yeah, the yes, the if I, you ask if I could elaborate a bit more the yes to suffering. Frankl, I take this way to elaborate it. Frankl spoke about meaning and said there are three main roads to meaning. Experiential meanings, like when we experience something good, a good meal, a good music, a good sleep, a good experience of sports, and so on. Productive values, when we produce something good, not receiving, but making. When we make a good meal, when we have a good talk, when we help somebody, then we are producing values. And then he said there are sometimes life situations where we can neither experience nor do valuable things. When we are simply suffering and have to endure that suffering because we cannot change it. Then, he said, there is another possibility. There is a value in it, hidden in it, which he called attitudinal value. The value of my attitude towards it. When I cannot change the situation. Somebody died, for instance. What can I do? I can change my attitude. My attitude towards this loss, towards this fate, towards this catastrophe. The attitude is, ultimately, my attitude towards life. The attitude towards life, which comes through in such a situation, the attitude is comes first in brings up first the a bit of freedom. How can I deal with that suffering? We suffer differently. People suffer differently, and there is a bit of choice possible. There is a bit of freedom. We can suffer silently, loudly, we can be rebellious, we can get drunk, we can be aggressive, we can be regressive. A bit of choice may be there. And we can also choose for whom we are doing it. And there the attitude becomes more graspable. Am I doing my suffering for the sake that other people do not have to suffer so much, that my relatives don't suffer from my suffering or do not suffer so much, so I may choose to be a lot with me or to be in silence instead of blaming other people or calling them constantly and trying to delegate my suffering to them. So this can be one possible meaning, an attitude towards the other. It can be that I undergo this suffering for the sake of being sincere with myself, that I can look into my eyes, that I don't give me up, that I behave in a way that I do not have to detest me or to devaluate me, but in the contrary, that I can say, at least I was true to myself, I was honest with myself. I didn't lose my self-esteem, my self-worth. I can do it for God, saying, because of my religion, it's a sacrifice. There are some small possibilities, and these possibilities can bring meaning into my suffering, and then I can accept my suffering by saying, okay, I cannot change it, but I do not want to give up. This is maybe the deepest value in it. I do not give up my relationship to life. I feel that life is something which could be good, which was good, at least partly. And me in my life is of value. I have a dignity which I do not want to lose. And for this, I live now with this suffering. So this is the way how Frankl described this dealing with suffering. And this was a tremendous contribution of Viktor Frankl's logotherapy to psychology and psychotherapy. This work on the meaning of suffering, and his life and his endurance of the concentration camp, which is described in the book Man's Search for Meaning, is symbolic for that, of course. So the issue of accepting suffering is a difficult one in our life. No one wants suffering, and suffering itself is not meaningful. The loss does not have meaning. But my dealing with it, by this attitudinal value, which I realize, the dealing with it may be meaningful. There is a possibility. We cannot claim from people to do it. We can only offer them, show them the possibility, talk with them about this, and that this is possible. What is possible for you, this is what you have to decide. To find out. We may help you, assist you in that. We may look with you into your concrete situation. What could be your way to keep up something of value? And this makes like a summary of one's life. It's like the final addition of my life, all the posts of my life in such a difficult life situation are brought together so that I can say, well, I want to keep up these ultimate values of life itself, of my dignity, of my religious belief, or whatever is my ultimate meaning in it, my ultimate value, my biggest value in it. And that's very impacting in our life. frankly, who had to suffer very much, wrote in 1946, in the first year of the war, in the book Homo Patiens, The Suffering Man. The last phrase was, suffering makes the world transparent and the man hellsichtig, visionary. Suffering opens the eyes for a deeper sight of existence. Suffering which ended in a meaning, which was, has been brought into a meaningful suffering. Suffering can kill, of course. Suffering, we can fall into despair, and it's not guaranteed that we overcome suffering. But there is a possibility. Hopefully we can grasp it. Thank you. Yeah, maybe you are.
Please.
Yeah, the work, existential analytical work with personality disorders, especially psychopaths or antisocial, dissocial personality disorders. Psychotherapeutic work with personality disorders is a hard and long-lasting work. I don't know if you in North America can do it, because you must be so quick in psychotherapy. It must be done in 10 hours. In Europe, we need, for the treatment of personality disorders, we need years, 5 years, 7 years. This is the normal. Every week a session. And in crisis situations, even more. And so we also, when we treat people with antisocial or dissocial personality disorders, it needs years, and we can improve them. We have colleagues, many of these antisocial personality disorders are imprisons. They became criminal because they do not have any moral conscience, visible conscience, and act in a way that the society, that they violate the rules of a society. Therefore, most of them end up in prison. And then in prison they get therapy. And it's good to have them in prison because they cannot run away. And if they are long enough in prison, we can have some effects that they start to have more ethical, moral feelings by encountering. What we apply in existential analysis is we work mainly with the dialogue and encountering, and we do the process by trying to stimulate the own felt experience of the situation, and with this felt experience we give our experience to it. Especially with personality disorders, it's important that the therapist encounters the person with his own personality. Then this is the strongest effect on it. But they need years to develop this, what hasn't been developed in their childhood and adolescence. So let's say if they do the work of 3 years development in 1 year of treatment, they do it quite well. But it means 20 years, it means 7 years. 7 times 3 is 20 years. So they can grow. Yeah, the psychotherapeutic work in existential analysis is mainly focused around this inner consent. We try to look at what for what do you have inner consent? What into what are you in tune? And we train them and to develop their inner dialogue so that they can process the situation. And so this is really effective. Then, of course, we have specific treatments for anxiety with specific methods. Frankl developed the famous paradoxical intention in the treatment of anxiety, or the reflection. But we have more techniques and methods in, specific for diagnosis. And in our training, we work mainly in the basic training. We work on these dimensions of existence, because each of these dimensions is a big themes to work on acceptance, for instance. What it does it mean, and how can it be strengthened or evolved, or what are the prerequisites to be able to accept or to endure? And there is a next layer underneath of that, and so it goes deep until the deepest ground in each of these four directions, the deepest ground is rooted in spirituality. The spirituality of being, for instance, is where we experience astonishment. Astonishment is something when we are confronted with something which transpasses us, or transcends us, which is much bigger than I, which I can't believe to be real. Let's say the little Mozart playing piano with 6 years in front of the empress. Empress. So astonishing. Is that possible? A child can play so well piano. It's phenomenal. Then we are astonished. Or in sports, somebody who does extreme swimming, Phelps in his swimming, it's incredible. One can't believe, and we are astonished. Astonishment means I can't take it. It transcends me. It's much bigger. I couldn't do that. I can't even imagine that somebody can do it. Then I'm astonished. And when I think about the universe or me being there, ultimately we can't understand it. And we can be astonished about the fact. And this is the deep dimension when we look into the basic trust, the fundamental trust, and that this trust is rooted in the ground of being, as Heidegger describes it in Being and Time, the ground of being, which we can touch. We cannot understand it anymore, but we can feel it. And if we feel a ground of being, this is a spiritual experience. It is still psychological. It doesn't mean that one must have a religious belief. And it's even better if persons who have a religious belief, if they have this psychological feeling of a ground of being, that there is something which makes me feel that I am carried. I am supported. Ultimately, even if I die, I am supported. Even if I am sick, even if I despair, I may have that fundamental trust, this giving me up to that universe, or to that cosmic order, whatever it is we we do not know it by ourselves, but we can feel to be hold, carried. Then this is basic trust, and if this is there, there is less anxiety in life, etc. And we can work until this depth to enlarge and sometimes to make it conscious, but mainly to help people to feel it. And then it's easier to come to an inner consent in life when I have access to these deep spiritual layers of our existence. Maybe this is a good end for our discussion. What do you think? Yeah. So thank you very much and have a good time and have a good use of this, what we talked about.
Thank you very much, Alfred. And thank you all for being here tonight, for coming. It was short notice, and we stayed even longer than we said. I'm hoping that it was indeed valuable for you, that you were here with a full inner consent to being here. Good. So thank you very much for coming. There are still some chocolates on the way out. Please help yourselves. Good night.